Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham sami. I like to remember the Buddhist teachings in sort of two streams. When I think of the teachings of the Buddha, I think in terms of the his teachings on like social responsibility and individuality in the way I live my life. And the other way is the way of observing the stream of consciousness and understanding the events in consciousness and how I create suffering through ignorance and how I can liberate the heart from suffering by understanding the way things are. And those two, I think it's very important to try to get that clear, because if you only talk about the inner world and understanding the inner world, then the references about our social life are missing. And we have a social life, we have responsibilities, we live in families or monasteries or wherever. But if you only have the social, the kind of the conventional truths that we live by, then, and we don't address the inner world, then we'll never get it right. Because you can never find perfection or freedom or peace in any external object or any external social situation. They're always fraught with change and oftentimes out of control. So I something like in my life as a senior monk, I have lots of responsibilities, and I often think life is problematic, so don't make it a problem. I have to deal with the problems, the things that come up, the lack of resources or misunderstandings or whatever it is. I have to always deal with that, it's life. But don't make it a problem. If I just dismissed I didn't have to pay attention to the problematic nature of life, then it would just be chaos. It would be even worse and be very hard to actually reflect on the inner world. But if I thought that the externalities of my life, the monastery, the people I live with, were somehow, if I get that all right, I'll find some state of social perfection, that's very deluded. And any of us who have lived over 13 years understand that, I think. So life is complex, life has problems, but we don't have to suffer. We need certain requisites to live life decently, and we have a responsibility, I think, as much as possible, to give others the chance to live decently. So if we have extra resources, we try to share those resources for those who are less fortunate than us. So the social structures that the Buddha points to are, in my life, one of the ways we think about this in terms of what the Buddha laid out in his teachings, when he was asked who his Dharma heir was, who would be the next person in charge of the monastic order and the teachings and so on, he left no person in charge. He didn't leave a Dharma heir, as it were. He said, "I leave you the Dhamma and the Vinaya." And I often repeat this. And the Vinaya is the code of the monastic code that Venerable Chunda and I live by, and monks and nuns live by. And this defines our social life. For the laity, the Buddha laid down more general rules, because each person lives a much more individual life, and it would be impossible to lay down highly detailed codes of living for various kinds of livelihoods that people live by and various kinds of cultures they live in. So for Venerable Chunda and I we live by a rule which defines the way we do legal processes, the way we use share resources in the monastery, the various moral principles that we live by, the ways of paying respect to our elders, and so on and so forth. It's quite detailed, and it's a very useful tool for living in communal life, living community. For the laity, these definitions are less, they're much broader, say. So the basic recommendations that the Buddha gives to the lay community is to live a life of moral restraint. So impulses which are harmful to myself or others, to not follow those as much as possible, and impulses which are wholesome, which are based upon generosity, compassion, goodness, responsibility to act those out, to live those out. So there's that in the way we live our social lives, which is restrained. If we don't restrain our appetites, we'll just get more and more confused. If we don't restrain our speech when we want to, if we're tempted to like all of us have sent emails which we, as soon as we did the send button, we regretted it. Everyone's done that one. So communication, which is skillful, which is truthful, which brings harmony to community, is part of the social ethic that the Buddha recommended. Communication which is divisive, which is filled with divisive kind of gossip, or which is untruthful, or which just comes from some passionate emotion which is unconsidered, that the Buddha would say, be careful, be restrained, be more mindful with that. Around life itself, to live a life of refraining from harming sentient beings. So the big challenge for me and most of us in the monastery is the bugs. I don't try to, you know, I'm not interested in hunting. The deer are fine, porcupines are fine, skunks are fine, coyotes are fine, mosquitoes and deer flies, don't like them. So it's very hard actually not to just go whack. You know, that's the impulse in me to destroy that which is I don't like. So I watch my mind, and I try to watch my body. I try to refrain from killing. So the first precept of Buddhist practice is a life of harmlessness, not to harm, not to hurt sentient beings. But on the other hand, to live a life of generosity and sharing one's life in a goodness. And this is a very, very good result in the heart. This gives us a sense of self-respect, gives a sense of we don't have a lot of fear or remorse in the mind. To live a life of honesty in our dealings, not to be deceitful in the way we deal with life, not to cheat and so on, but rather to be impeccable in the dealings of life. This leads to a beautiful sense of self-respect, a beautiful sense of I've done it right, I haven't cheated, I haven't lived a life of exploiting others in ways which are not impeccable. A life of fidelity, a life of where we learn to understand our appetites and not be the victims to just a constant pursuit of our appetites, to find some sense of moderation around those things, fidelity in relationships. Communication, sobriety. These are principles which I think we all agree to, and they're very, very important, very, very important. And then the heart of generosity, a heart which is willing to share in the goodness that each of us has, a heart which is sensitive to the needs of others, a heart which is able to not just be so self-consumed that we don't observe how others are feeling or what they need and so on. So generosity and morality are the foundation, the social foundation for a good living. And I know for myself, like living with the monastic code, it really has fostered, like I don't have any remorseful memories. Because, you know, how much harm can you do? You know, kill a mosquito every now and then out of annoyance or whatever, that's not so bad. Having lived an honest life, there's a basis for meditation. is the foundation for a heart which is at ease with its history, with my own history. And so the five precepts of Buddhism: to refrain from killing, to refrain from stealing, to refrain from sexual misconduct, to refrain from lying or harsh speech, to refrain from intoxicating drugs which leads to carelessness. These are really beautiful foundation. And they're the passive or the restrained part of our social life. And then the active part is the compassion, the generosity, the ability to develop skills, the ability to use intelligence, to have a good livelihood, to maintain the needs of my family, to try to create better environments to live in, to deal with climate change, and so on and so forth. That's the sort of expressive part of our life. Because we have an expressive part. We need to express ourselves. We need to develop that part. And then we have a part which is also restrained, isn't it? Where I don't just say everything I want to all the time, because that kind of a mouth communication that way is unrestrained, leads to a lot of regret or social confusion. So these are not ideals, they're principles that we try to live by. And like communication is very hard, isn't it? To get right speech, to do that right day in, day out, it's not easy. It's not easy. Quite often we find ourselves saying things we wish we hadn't said. And that's why it's very important not just to take these moral principles and the social principles as ideals that are somehow make you feel guilty. To like, if I just lose the plot every now and then, and like a deer fly was biting me this afternoon, and I just went, oops. So I had a bite and I had a dead deer fly. That's against the precepts, obviously. But I'm not going to, feel guilty about that for 20 days. That would be stupid, wouldn't it? But I can be, just be more careful, be more mindful. So the restraint that the Buddha asks me to keep around a little thing like that makes me more mindful, makes me more careful. I won't get it perfect. I'll probably not kill any human beings. I'll probably get that one down. I'm pretty safe there. But if I had some image of moral perfection, and that I did that and I felt guilty about it, that would not be a reflective use of moral principles. It would be a kind of attachment to that idea that I should never kill. I am someone who should never kill. Rather than a reflection to help me to be more mindful, to be more careful. Same with speech. If I inadvertently, send off an email which was ill considered and hurtful, then I can reflect on that. Oh, that wasn't wise. That was uncool, literally, in the heat of the moment. And I can reflect, and I can, next time that impulse comes up, I can try to practice restraint. So the moral principles aren't absolutes. They're not kind of philosophical absolutes. Like having killed the deer fly will now drop into some kind of eternal hell and be punished forever by deer flies or something like that. That'd be hellish, right? But rather, it's just to make me more mindful, more careful. And that care is important because it does lead to a sense of goodness in your own heart. And one of the things that we're often recommended in our lifestyle is to reflect on your goodness, because oftentimes we are we're idealistic, we attach to ideals, and we're very self-critical of just the most minor kind of things in our mind. We can be very, very self-critical, the imperfections which we perceive, others might not perceive. We could be very self-critical. And that's an unkindness we do to ourselves, but it can be so habitual and seem so real that that gets us very depressed and makes us very unhappy. So one of the things that's recommended is to reflect on your goodness. And that, oftentimes, for Westerners, that's not conceited. It's arrogant, isn't it, to reflect on your goodness? But it's not, it's true. If I'm not killing people, I'm not robbing banks or so on, it's a good thing. And if I've helped someone, a little old lady across the street, that's a good thing. Or if I've given someone a cup of tea, or been kind or generous, these are good things. So I think that's very important, to remember the goodness of our lives, and not to just to focus on the faults. We work with the faults, right? And we learn from them. But the very perception of faults can be quite harsh, can be quite unkind. I was involved in building a monastery with Ajahn Kusalo in New Zealand, Wellington, capital of New Zealand, federal capital. And it was a really fabulous project. We were given a piece of land, and I was the senior monk there, and I was trying to figure out, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? And this young architect came and said, I hear you need an architect. And I said, yes. And he ended up working pro bono, designing this meditation hall. He went to IMS to do a 3-month retreat before actually working on this meditation hall. He was the project manager, the architect, and he's a very good carpenter. So he was like doing everything. And we were just covering some basic costs. It was almost totally pro bono. And he won the award for the best building of its type in New Zealand that year by the Architectural Association. So it was a wonderful, wonderful story. Really, really wonderful story, because he's a fairly well-known architect now. And he says to me, you could never afford me now. A lovely, lovely, lovely man. And I asked him, I said, when you come into the hall, do you see the faults? He said, well, of course I do. But I have to be very careful to guard my mind from just looking at the faults. To me, it was exquisite. Beautiful, beautiful building. And he could see this, he could see that, because he did the design of the building. And the mind can do that sometimes, can't it? Where it just focuses on some negative aspect, which is like 1% of 1%, but holds attention on that. And that holding of attention on that creates a kind of very suffering kind of reality. A reality which to other people, say, well, it's not a big deal. Why make it a big deal? But we can make it a big deal. And that's a lack of insight and a lack of inner reflection that does that. Because we take these things very personally, and then we attach to them through memory, through idealism, in whatever ways, and we get stuck in these perceptions of me and my life around me and my history, and me and you, and so on and so forth. So the second way, when we think about the Buddhist teachings, is the way of now stepping out of the conventional realm of me as Viradhammo, with my responsibilities and my calendar and my diary, and all of that, which defines me. And now it's just being the witness to the changing nature of conscious experience. And you have, you know, what we try to do is try to do both. I try to live a good life, try to be responsible in my social life, but within that, I'm always trying to develop a sense of inner vigilance, inner witnessing, inner awareness. And that part of the teaching then doesn't talk about me and my social relationships. It just tries to talk about the stream of consciousness in very kind of abstract terms. So what do I notice in the stream of conscious events that I live in, as it were, or experience, is there's a body. And there are bodily feelings. Heat, so I feel the heat. And I think fans could be stronger. I feel tension in the body, I feel coldness, I feel pressure. So part of being incarnate in this human form is body. And as in the conventional sense, I go to the doctor, and the doctor says I have too much cholesterol, so I take statins. And then everyone tells, don't take statins, and then there's all that confusion. But that's another story. But that's the conventional realm, right? So there is a body, and that needs to be taken care of. But in the way of inner vigilance or inner awareness, I notice bodily feelings coming and going, coming and going. And that's what I suggested in this meditation, that you observe the body now, not as my body with its aches and pains and all of that, but now as just a bodily form of physical sensations changing. Right? So both ways are important. Take care of the body, exercise as much as possible, feed it the right things, and so on and so forth. But to begin to also have this relationship to the body, which is the relationship of the awareness of change. And that's very important. Because my relationship to the body in some sense has to be personal. This is Veerdhamma's body, 67 years old, needs a bit of band-aids every now and then, and it likes certain kinds of foods, and da-da-da-da-da-da, right? It shouldn't. So there's that personal part, and that's important. But there's also, and once you begin to see that the body is a formation in nature, it's a natural formation, just as the sound is natural, the sights are natural, so the body is a formation in nature. And the interesting thing is it can be known in a way which is not personal. It's individual, like your knees will feel different than my knees, your head will feel different than my head, but it's not personal in the sense it's not something that I own, it's a function in nature. And so how I try to indicate that is I suggest listen to sound, feel the body. And it's a very interesting exercise. You close your eyes and you're no longer identifying with anything, you just listen to sound, feel the body. You see that the bodily sensations are in awareness and sound is in awareness, and they have equal value. They have equal value. They're arising and ceasing. And to notice this through the perception of change, to relate to this through the awareness of change, is the path to peace, is the path to liberation. The moral things are important. They're also the path to peace because they set the social foundation of stability and self-respect and non-chaos and non-confusion in our social lives. And then this inner attitude. Now, I can relate to my body as a personal thing, but I can also relate to it through the awareness of change. Now, this is more nebulous. It's not, it's kind of very vague in the beginning, because when I say to you, be aware of the changing nature of body, you kind of, well, so what? And no big deal, because it's not an experience. If you're looking for an experience in meditation, then if I tell you now, you know, breathe really, really strong, you breathe really, really strong and get your chakras going, you might get an experience. It might be very helpful. But the awareness of change is not an experience. It's an attitude. And it's that attitude, the awareness of change, that we try to cultivate. Because if we can do that, and this takes a lot of persistence, it takes a lot of patience, but if we can abide as that witness to change, we begin to see that the awareness of change is where peace lies, not in the things that change. Peace does not lie in your body. Anyone not figured that one out yet? If you're over 65, you know it's downhill from now on. So, where does peace lie? Does it lie in keeping the body perfect? Can't be. Sure, you know, take care of it as best you can, because then it's as comfortable as it can be, but with the awareness of change, that's always possible. So take something like physical discomfort. And I think this is a very important lesson in meditation. I often talk about it, is that when you meditate, within 5 minutes, within a minute, you start to feel physical discomfort. It's a very, very ordinary kind of experience. But it's not necessarily hurtful. It's just that the body has comfort and discomfort. It's its nature. It has comfort and discomfort. Now, if I'm always choosing comfort over discomfort, I will never find peace. Because inevitably, the comfort changes to discomfort. It's its nature. I'm not rejecting comfort. I'm not saying that thou shalt always feel discomfort, no matter what. That would be an attachment to an opinion, right? But to reflect on discomfort as a function in nature, what does that do if you notice it as change? Well, what I find is that if I'm meditating and then I start to feel some discomfort in some part of the body, if I relate to that through the awareness of change, then the discomfort usually, unless it's quite painful, usually just settles out. My body relaxes and it changes into non-discomfort or comfort. Quite often you notice that. And why does that happen? Why does that happen? Because I've now noticed something which before I would have reacted with desire. I desire the comfort and I want to get rid of the discomfort. And that's biological. I mean, it's a good thing. If we didn't have that, we'd be very, very harmed. But there are times of discomfort where it's okay. It's just discomfort. Like heat, let's say. If I feel it's hot in this room. Right? I feel hot. Maybe I my shirt underneath is a bit too thick. Wrong choice. Wrong strategy there. I can't take this off in front of you. I'd embarrass Venerable Chunda. Don't want to do that. So I feel heat. I feel discomfort. And that's, you know, it's okay. Nothing wrong with it. But actually, to be aware of discomfort and heat through the awareness of change, what happens? Well, the awareness of change then begins to accept the discomfort as a condition in nature. And I begin to find peace with discomfort. It doesn't mean that I can't go downstairs, take my shirt off, da-da-da-da-da. But why not practice with it? It's not harmful. It doesn't really hurt me. So I actually practice. And so I'm now witnessing change, but I'm also witnessing my desire for certain experiences in the changing nature of phenomena. And it's desire that's most important here. Because desire for comfort can never be fully satisfied, because discomfort and comfort are part of one package. It's just the way it is. Right? Again, not to deny the strategic uses of comfort. That's fine, right? But is there any other refuge in my mind which is not dependent on comfort and not averse to discomfort? Yes, the awareness of change. Right? And that's, you know, if you take a lesson like that, which is not life-threatening, it's not difficult, it's very easy to watch, you begin to see that the awareness of change is a peaceful attitude, is a space, is consciousness within which things can be known, arising and ceasing, and you don't always have to react to them. In fact, you begin to be able to not react to them. Take something like a sound, maybe. A sound which is not like, when I ask you to listen to sound, most of the sounds are pretty neutral. Maybe the sound of the strong fan there, you found a bit too strong. Most of us wouldn't. But let's say I'm sitting here, I'm used to being in a home which has absolutely no sound, very, very quiet, and then there's the sound of the large fan. And now that will be uncomfortable to my preferences. My preferences are for silence, and then in contrast to my preferences, this sound is here. If I'm mindful, and I'm just aware, you know, unpleasant, feels this way, and I relate to it through the awareness of change, then the unpleasant goes to the neutral, and it's just a background sound. I think most of us do that. But if I then relate to it through desire to have it off, the whole meditation's a wipeout. Right? And I just keep, and I go and complain to the management. Why don't you get better fans? And then I believe in that. This is the tragedy of projection. Then this is a facetious example, but you know, then afterwards I go and complain, you know, why don't people get a better fan or whatever? You know, what kind of a place is this? Ridiculous, isn't it? Ridiculous. And yet people do that on bigger issues. So relating to something through the awareness of change rather than relating it to the desire for pleasure. You see what I mean? Without dismissing pleasure, without saying it's wrong to have pleasure or comfort or beauty, without dismissing it, but the beginning to see that the whole nature of pleasure, pain, comfort, discomfort, liking, disliking, is the nature of change. This is the way it is. And that in those changing phenomena and objects and conditions and situations and relationships, you'll never find stability. You'll never find stability. But in this different kind of relating through the awareness of change, you begin to find stability because all things change. Right? Now this is a very, in the beginning when you do this, it seems very unfruitful, very kind of ho-hum, big deal, kind of no big deal, because it's not an experience. But take something more difficult. Let's take you got betrayed 5 years ago by someone in business or marriage or whatever, and it was a really nasty piece of karma or experience that you had to go through. And then 5 years later, you think you've worked it through. And then someone mentions the person that cheated you. and says they're great, not a lovely person. And what that triggers in you is murderous impulse. Really, you know.
How could you say that?
Now, to relate to that, and that's very uncomfortable, isn't it? Very uncomfortable. And usually, you know, something that can be so strong, you can't resist saying, you know what they did to me? They're not a good person. And you spew it all out, right? Because you relate from attachment. I relate from attachment. And one might do that a few times and see, well, that doesn't work either. That just confuses me and just reignites all of that. And then one begins to make an intention. I'm going to try to notice the arising of this memory, if it comes up, through the relationship of awareness of change. And that's a bit more difficult, because it's so uncomfortable. But let's say that then that memory comes up, I'm on my own, and that memory of betrayal comes up. Now that's very unpleasant. That's very unpleasant. And what does the desire mind want to do? The desire mind wants to get rid of it. So it either runs to blame, so hatred is a way of trying to get rid of it. It runs to distraction, food or drugs or whatever, or television or whatever you want. It doesn't want to experience the discomfort because it's very uncomfortable. Now to actually witness that through the awareness of change takes a lot of patience, a lot of courage, but I have found in these kinds of things, this is a testimonial, that when I make that determination or that intention, and when I have enough mindfulness and awareness and presence and understand my own conditioning around something difficult, and then finally I have enough, okay, what is it really like to feel, to actually feel this sense of betrayal? It's very, very uncomfortable. And my desire mind does not want to stay with it. But as I stay with it, I begin to abide as that awareness of change. That's my refuge. And the thing changes and changes and changes and eventually ceases. And many things happen there. The fear of that falls away. The belief in that falls away. The reignition of that falls away. The fuel for that falls away. And the refuge in awareness of change becomes more profound. I begin to trust that more. I begin to realize that is the path, the awareness of change, rather than changing this ugly thing which is now arisen in consciousness. And you can see that takes a lot of patience. Because it just, yeah, I should do something about it, at least analyze it. Right? And that's a deadly trap too. Because I can, well, I have to analyze this now. I have to figure out, you know, what in my chain, whatever I have to do. But if I'm already aware of it, I don't need to analyze it. I just need to be patient. I just need to let it run its course, let the storm run its course. And so patience is very, very important. But not a patience which is just blind. It's a patience which is wise. No, this will change. This has a nature to arise. This is memory. And so we go to the other factors which the Buddha suggested we become aware of in the flow of consciousness. So we have body, we have feelings. You know, we feel things. We feel pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So when I have a memory of something really horrible, it might be grief, it might be a fearful memory, it might be a feeling of betrayal or something that I did which was very cruel or whatever, the memory has tremendous power. It affects me on a visceral level, on a physical level. I have narrative memories, and all of it, right? It's very powerful. And to kind of take that package, that is the flow of objects in consciousness. And that which knows, that which is aware of change, is my refuge. And this is what we mean by Buddha knowing Dharma. When we take refuge in Buddha, and we take refuge in Dharma, these are very basic principles to Buddhism. Taking refuge in Buddha is not, in Buddha, is not a historical being, but it's that very awake attitude to Dharma. And what is Dharma? Dharma is the way things are now. You know, this moment is feeling like this now, this moment of grief, or this moment of memory, of betrayal. It feels just like this right now. So awareness of change is awareness of Dharma. And that is a true refuge, because this will change. This will change. And if I allow that witnessing consciousness to function, then I begin to see it's all right. You know, it's unpleasant, but it's all right. It's just unpleasant. It will change. And so I begin to see these objects in consciousness, bodily feelings, heart feelings, memories and perceptions, all the mental constructs that go into our lives, sights, sounds, tastes, smells, bodily feelings, all these things are just part of the program of being human, just part of the package of being human. We are incarnate in these bodies, this is the way it is. One of the things Ajahn Sumedho was teaching, he did a day long in Portland just a few days ago. They had the opening of a new center in Portland, and he did a day long, and he emphasized a lot that the nature of being human and having all these conditions is that it all belongs, the whole package from ugly to beautiful, that it is a function in nature, it arises to causes and conditions, and our only real way of being with that in peaceful ways is to be fully conscious to it. And this is the attitude of what we call metta. Metta, or it's usually translated as loving kindness. But loving kindness has a difficult word to interpret, because loving kindness implies liking. But this kind of open acceptance to the changing nature of things, living within moral boundaries, living within my social responsibilities, you know, not just being passive, but in that life of social responsibility, accepting it all, being open to it all, is what I think is more like the transcendent understanding of metta or kindness. Because it all does belong, right? Even if I so-called make a mistake and I yell at you from some really bad mood, that's a part of it. That's a part of nature. Sure, I try to correct my behavior, but that's a part of nature. Making mistakes is a part of nature. Saying foolish things is a part of nature, as saying wise things. Because if I only have that, only saying wise things is Buddhism, I'm in trouble. Because I can say some really dumb things. But if I say, well, saying dumb things is probably not so skillful, and I'll probably live a better life by doing that, but if I do it, okay, that's the way it is. And remorse and regret, these are a very natural part of our life. And the kind of sense of just idealizing ourselves to being these perfected beings who always feel kindness to our children or to our spouse, or always, you know, life just is not that way. So Dharma is the way things are. And how are things? How are things now? Well, they're comfortable, uncomfortable. They're pleasant, they're unpleasant. I like them, I don't like them. That's Dharma. Whereas idealism is, I only want the comfortable, the beautiful, the harmonious, da-da-da-da-da, in my own mind and in your mind, and the others are unacceptable. That's not Dharma. That's preference. That's desire. And we can certainly, I prefer milk in my coffee, right? But I know that's not liberation. It's just getting what I want. So I like to get what I want. I'm not going to sleep on a bed of nails and wear a hair shirt and beat myself with whips or something. No, I like comfort. But I realize that discomfort has an important lesson. And so the Buddha's teaching takes, as Ajahn Sumedho was saying in this day long, he takes the most mundane, banal, ordinary thing in life, suffering. The thing we want to get rid of, the thing that we don't want, he says, awaken to that. Make that your point of awakening, because in that there's the key to non-suffering. So I feel the heat in the room, and I make conscious that feeling of discomfort. I make that fully conscious. This is the Dharma of heat. This is the Dharma of not wanting. It feels this way. And I stay with that, and I begin to be at peace with the way things are. With the heat in the body, with the heat in the room. That's an easy example. Other things are more difficult, emotional things, loss and family, sickness, and so on. The aging process. Ajahn Sumedho is 80 years old, and what's the date today? 4th of July? Mm-hmm. In 23 days, he was going to be 80 years old, full. And so we were visiting his, where he grew up in Seattle, and University of Washington, And he was saying, you know, 80 years ago, I was in my mother's womb at this time, about to pop into the world, to be known into the world. And being, you know, being born into this human realm, life presents itself the way it presents itself. And we age, and then there's death. But awareness of change is something that is beyond change, isn't it? And when I notice the changing nature of the moods of my mind, and I abide in that, then I begin to see, well, that's not changing. Certainly sometimes it can seem like I've lost the plot and so on, but the awareness of change is something that's always available. It's always a possibility. And that's why we say it's the gateway to transcendence, or the spiritual part of our life, or the deathless, as the Buddha talked about, or Nibbana, these different kinds of words we use, awareness of change. And it because it's not an experience per se, we miss it. We jump over it. We try to get rid of thinking. We try to get some kind of transcendent experience, maybe an experience we've had. So one of the great difficulties that we have as meditators is trying to manufacture a pleasant experience we've had in meditation. And, you know, those of you who have been at this game for a while, you know what a disaster that is. So, you know, you meditate and you get some really boing kind of experience, and then you think, that's it. You're not aware of change. You've now taken a position, and that's it. That thing I had 2 days ago. So today, the mind's totally confused. Can't sit still. And what do I want? I don't want to be with that discomfort. I want to make conscious the feeling of suffering, first noble truth. I want that which I had before. And I'm not aware. Because I'm not aware, what do? I buy into desire. Desire to get rid of this particular discomfort so that I can have that experience which I had before. Well, that desire just keeps me restless, and I just get up and have a coffee or go watch TV because, you know, the whole thing's a disaster. But that's not awareness of the way things are. That's the desire to change things the way things are. So the Buddha's recommendation is to take this most ordinary thing, the most common thing that we all have, that we want to get rid of, and to use that as your point of awakening. So I feel discomfort in the body. I'm meditating. I become fully conscious of discomfort. I also become conscious of the desire to get rid of. And I see that desire as a tension. You know, and I begin to observe desire as changing. Not to say that the desire is wrong and not to repress it or get rid of it, but just see desire as something which is changing. And then I begin to see that desire arises and ceases. And in that cessation, I begin to see, wow, I can be at peace without always having to follow my desires. I can be at peace with unfulfilled desire, which is really neat. It's really lovely, because that you begin to see, yeah, there is liberation. Then my desires can be in context. You know, where is desire appropriate? I'm feeling some kind of pain, so I go to the dentist, or I'm feeling hungry, so I eat food, or whatever. So desire has its place. But now I'm no longer just the victim of unfulfilled desire. I can see, no, there is a place in the heart which can be with unfulfilled desire. I can feel lonely. I can feel confused. And I can relate to that loneliness and confusion through the awareness of change. I can relate to loneliness through personal, as a personality. And then, oh, I feel so lonely. No one loves me. And, oh, gosh, my life is down the tube. I'm a monk. And I never had a family, and I never had a Lexus, and you know, I've never thought that way. But it, you know, I could take loneliness and create it as a personal problem. Oh, why do I feel lonely? And analyze it, do whatever. Or I could relate to it through the awareness of change. And that, again, that takes a lot of patience. Because who wants to feel lonely? I don't want to feel lonely. But what do? If I don't allow that loneliness to be there, then I seek a compensation, a substitute. And that substitute takes me to loneliness too. But if I'm aware of loneliness and arises, and something good arises in my life to alleviate, that's fine. But if I just have the courage and patience, loneliness feels this way. This is the Dharma of loneliness. And it ceases, and I don't need a compensation. I find peace with the way things are. This, again, it does. This, it requires a lot of patience. And I think sometimes we do, in our Western culture, we sometimes overanalyze things. I know I've suffered from that, where I've tried to figure things out at an intellectual level and not wanting to feel just the rawness of my experience. And I noticed that my desire to figure it out intellectually is a desire to get rid of. Somehow I think that if I just figure out why this is the way it is, I won't feel this feeling. But it's just thought. It's just an idea. So even if I come to the opinion, or some kind of analytical opinion, then still I have a feeling to deal with. But if I just say, well, this is the Dharma of change, this is the Dharma of loneliness, it arises, it stays for a while, it ceases, and I take that mantra on board, awareness of change, I take that perception, that becomes incredibly powerful, and I begin to see where the freedom of human consciousness is, that very consciousness is freedom, not a condition, not an emotion, not a bodily feeling, not a memory, not a perception, not a mental construct, not a sight, not a sound, but something which knows all of those is changing. It's very subtle. It's very subtle. The awareness of change is very obvious. It's very obvious. All right? I'll leave that for reflection.